How will we live as we slip into the 21st century?
From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. What does our future hold? As the divide between the haves and the have-nots grows, as challenges like global warming and a burgeoning population loom, are we spending enough time thinking about the future? For the next hour, we'll talk about what everyday life in the United States might look like 50 or 100 years from now, and ask, are we doing enough to create the future we want? Let's start at home. Imagine it's the year 2055, a regular weekday morning. Where do you wake up? With a booming population and more people moving into urban areas, chances are you'd be living in a city, but what might that city look like? Mitchell Joachim is an architect and one of the founders of the innovative design group Terraform One. And Strange Champs asked him what it might be like to live in a future city.
So Mitchell, no matter how you look at it, we're looking at a lot more houses and a lot more buildings needing to be constructed in the future. You have this ingenious, wild, I don't know what to call it, idea that some of those buildings in the future will be made not of dead trees and steel beams, but of living materials. Can you explain?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we've had, a number of centuries where we've been thinking about building, where everything has been more mass-produced, highly unitized, incredibly modular. And in the more recent industrial age, everything is about this kind of factory model. Our group, Terraform One, has been looking at alternates, a link to the resources that the Earth's provided us, but do it in a way that we don't deplete them. And one such kind of system is thinking about living architectures, architectures that are comprised of directly of the metabolism or the systems you'd find in nature, and nudging them for human use, nudging them into geometries that are spaces that are occupiable, homes that are simply made from living elements that are adjusted so that we could find some sort of space or sanctity inside them.
I'm not totally sure I understand what you mean. Can you describe one?
I'll get into that minutia. So one project, Fab Treehab, is taking living trees or any woody plant matter, vines, etc., and growing them into a shape. So we provide scaffolding that's designed using computers and allowing the vines to be shaped inside that scaffolding and growing them into a home, attaching them to larger woody plant species such as trees and grafting all of the components together so they form one contiguous plant system.
What would it look like?
It would look like a home that would be essentially a part of the landscape. Almost no distinction between home and landscape. It would welcome all kinds of critters and creatures on the outside. And you can imagine it would be a treehouse, unlike nothing you've maybe seen before, but at the same time, it's just as if the landscape was folded up for a moment and you could get inside underneath it and live there. The inside would be like any other home. You could put your TV and your couch and plaster the walls, but the structure and the exterior would be made up of loam or mud filled in inside these woody plants and vines.
It sounds like something for elves or hobbits to live in.
Yeah, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but hobbit homes look like they fit into nature. And it's a different directive than we have today, which is this kind of box that makes up so much of the suburbs. And it's just not sustainable to continuously construct these kinds of homes.
So are you imagining, I don't know, future cities or villages that look more like urban forests in which there are all these kind of tree homes and little creatures are running around and there's leaves and little streams running through? Or is this too pastoral?
There's something wrong with the American sublime and these pastoral ideas of the countryside. I think if there will be folks living in the suburbs, I think the topology of the suburb, the basic building stock that we understand today is got to shift into something that has a kind of a fitness with nature. and we could use trees as they are and woody plants as they are in their local ecosystems and shape them for our own functional purposes. I think on the site, in the very location you desire to live, you could have a village for thousands of families made from the materials that are available there. The biggest criticism I've gotten for doing something like that is people are worried it takes a lot of time. But I think if we wait 12 years for a bottle of scotch, we can wait 12 years to grow a village of homes for 1,000-plus families that have a positive contribution to the environment.
I'm curious, as an architect, somebody who thinks deeply about what houses are and what they mean to us and our relationship with our houses, the structures we live inside, do you think we would have a different feeling about a house that was literally alive?
I mean, that's a great perspective. I think absolutely we would have a different connection, if not kinship, to a home that is living. There would be some idea of sentience. This is a breathing, connected mechanism to the earth, and we would have to respect it as such, as opposed to dead, harvested materials that have been processed, highly processed through some industrial system. I might even go so far that even in a distant future, we would think of extended phenotypes for people, much like a bird has a nest, which is very important to the life of the bird, or a spider and a web, a beaver and a dam, et cetera. These are kind of logical and built-in evolutionary extensions of the of those organisms. Humans at some point have probably lost that instinctual link to nature to make homes. So there's probably be a deeper return to that in the future at some point.
Were you raised on a lot of Grimm's fairy tales? Because all of this, it just sounds like something out of, those fairy tales.
Oh, thanks. Truth be told, many architects have been thinking about this for some time. They were called bioformalists. I mean, it started with someone like Frank Lloyd Wright, who talked about organic architecture. If you think of another famous architect in America, Frank Gehry, his forms for the Walt Disney Concert Hall are very organic, if I can use the term here, loosely flowing, very curvilinear, but essentially they're not organic. They are steel, metal, and glass. So the next logical phase has been this new generation, which I guess I'm a part of, is architects actually taking the computational systems extracted from nature, principles from Frank Lloyd Wright, and actually making a truly organic architecture where we're really working at the genetic level, or we're working with natural materials and growing them to perform as living systems.
So how would you scale that up to create mega cities?
Well, it's one step at a time. It's going to take a lot of folks working for a decade or more to solve some of the bigger problems that we're looking at in creating truly living architectures. I think that if cities are meant to be built today, to get them to be absolutely living, be a very difficult and expensive process. And unfortunately, we'll have to use more conventional means to build some of these cities. But that doesn't mean the infrastructure, the stuff that deals with waste, food, water, air quality, et cetera, mobility, isn't made to have a kind of a connection to nature, and that these kinds of flows, these metabolic flows, will link the cities logically so that we can have a sustainable urbanism.
So let's play out a couple of future scenarios. I mean, say we figure out how to build cities with new, more biological materials. Can you kind of paint a picture, walk me through the built environment of a person who might be living in a middle American city with an average income?
Well, first, let's hope we get there. If we can get past the amount of carbon we're putting in the atmosphere, think of a set of controls on our growth and our economy and all sectors, and that we're able to kind of be around the next 100 years because we figured out the system. I would imagine that someone in the future would be living in a place where there is no waste. Even the concept of waste would be completely gone away. There would be no term for waste. Everything would be upcycled constantly in a nutrient stream where it's being used and reused. And I would think that transportation would also be very different. So if you wake up in the morning, you would get to work if you don't work at home through a transportation system that is designed to fit cities. So it's not a kind of a universal one like the automobile is. We'll have a lot of shared ownership models for moving. public transportation, et cetera, and models of transportation that fit directly into the architecture.
So as we look at a future with a massive population increase and these mega cities, how are officials and urban planners and architects preparing for the growth of American cities right now?
We're arguing. Yeah, I think that's healthy. It's a large-scale, long-term polemic, fighting over utopia, which most of us dismiss outright. Not because utopia is a bad idea, but because many of us think there's a lot of good examples where it's failed. I would think that it's not about establishing a fantastic Shangri-La or some perfect environment for everybody. I think it's actually more of a goal of achieving a maximal answer to current real-world problems. And that, to me, is what a utopia is.
Mitchell Joachim is an architect and co-founder of Terraform One. He's also an associate professor at NYU and Switzerland's European Graduate School. Anne Strangechamps talked with him. So your future self's woken up at home on this weekday in 2055, time for work, right? What kind of work? With America's old industries sagging, what kind of jobs will we do? To tackle that question, Steve Paulson sat down with MIT management professor Eric Brynjolfsson.
Eric, what's shaping the future of our work lives?
Well, technology has always been changing our work lives, but lately technology has been accelerating, especially digital technologies. And so that's caused some really good things. Productivity's at a record high. Profits are at record highs. We're wealthier than we ever were before. But it's also caused some not so good things. The person at the 50th percentile of income distribution is poorer than he or she was in the 1990s. And of course, unemployment has been soaring as the share of people working has fallen.
Mm-hmm. Now, there have been predictions over the centuries even about what was supposed to happen with new technology. I mean, if you go back to electricity or the first robots or the invention of computers, there were all these people who had this very sort of rosy look that, oh, we're going to work less, but we'll still have good incomes. And mm-hmm. It does not seem to have worked out that way. And the interesting thing is I don't see that kind of optimism anymore. I mean, now I don't hear people saying, oh, with new technology, it's going to make our lives easier. What has changed?
Well, the technology is doing what it's supposed to be doing, and that is it is actually creating more wealth with less work. The problem is that our institutions, our skills, our organizations aren't keeping up. And so we're having a bigger and bigger mismatch between the technology and the rest of society. The result has been that this saving of work has not been evenly distributed. A small group of the population has really borne the brunt of this unemployment, and they're not working at all, even though they'd like to. And a lot of other people are working as much as ever, in fact, maybe too much. And the big challenge before us is to reinvent our organizations and institutions to keep up with the radical changes in technology.
What would that mean, to reinvent our institutions and organizations?
Well, you know, technology has always been creating jobs. It's always been destroying jobs. 200 years ago, 90% of Americans worked on farms. And then it was 42% in 1900. And now it's less than 2%. But along the way, we changed the kinds of work people did. All those people who aren't working on farms, they didn't simply become unemployed. Thomas Edison and Henry Ford and Steve Jobs and others helped invent entirely new industries. Today, that isn't happening nearly as rapidly. Sure, there's a fair amount of entrepreneurship, but the companies that are being started today don't need as many people. We're going to have to think about ways that people can be employed in new industries, and also we may have to start thinking about ways that people can share in the wealth even if they aren't working as much.
Now, is this are you getting at a divide between those who work in the tech industries and those who don't? I mean, basically, those who are the high-tech workers are, you know, they're going to be sitting pretty. They'll be employed. They'll, you know, make money. But the others will kind of be left out?
Well, that would be the first instinct, is to look at it that way, between tech and the rest of the economy. Actually, there's three sets of winners and losers. The first set is between high-skill workers and low versus middle-skill workers. People with only a high school education today have seen their incomes just fall off a cliff. The second one is between capital owners and labor providers. So as companies automate their operations, people who own capital equipment have captured a bigger and bigger share of the pie, and people who provide labor, who work in those factories, don't have as much to offer anymore. And then the third set of winners and losers is between what I would call superstars, or very lucky or talented individuals who have some special skill, and really the rest of us. All three of those sets of winners and losers have been affected increasingly by technology, and the gap is growing between the winning set and the losing set. And they all point in the same direction, which is greater income inequality and less job growth for the mass of people in the United States and other developed countries.
I have to say, this sounds like a fairly grim scenario for the future. I mean, most people are going to be left out, and they're not going to have those high skills. And it sounds like a fairly pessimistic future, doesn't it?
Well, it doesn't have to be. But certainly, if we do nothing, if we just continue the way we're going right now, it is a pessimistic future for 90% of people, or maybe even 99% of people. And I guess that's a pretty grim scenario. But it doesn't have to be that way. We could reskill a lot of people. We could change the way capital is allocated. We could try to be more aggressive about encouraging entrepreneurship. What we need to do is invent those new industries, like, say, Henry Ford and Steve Jobs did, that will employ people that have been, if you will, freed up from the old tasks. We're not doing that fast enough.
So what you're really talking about is the need to radically restructure our institutions, the way we think about work, the way we train people for productive lives. And I guess I'm wondering if this is just sort of going to happen organically, or whether there needs to be a more concerted policy to make it happen. I mean, is this the kind of thing that governments need to jump in on and spend billions of dollars to push us in the right direction?
I wish I could be more optimistic about government being helpful in this process. So far, there seems to be real paralysis down there. I mean, I love visiting Silicon Valley, or visiting the labs here at MIT, or all over the country. People are doing very dynamic things with technology. But I'm disappointed whenever I go to Washington and see the paralysis and infighting there. Few, if anybody, down there are thinking about these kinds of issues the way they need to. We have to actively redesign it, just as people did in the 20th century, when we moved from a farming agrarian economy to an industrial economy. There was a tremendous amount of restructuring of government and industry and regulation, and even our norms and our customs of how we ran organizations were quite radically redesigned. What I'm calling for going forward is a grand challenge to reinvent education and organizations right alongside the way that technology has been reinvented.
So who needs to take charge of this process?
I think we all need to get involved. I don't think we can wait for government to do it. I don't think there's going to be a single shining entrepreneur who rallies it all. The way these things tend to happen is by thousands or millions of people working on different parts of the problem. Somebody picking out, working on the education reinvention, other people looking at ways to get crowdsource employment opportunities in the sharing economy, for instance.
So, you know, in this hour, we are asking people to project forward 50 years to imagine what a typical American's day-to-day life might look like. So here's the hard part here. If you were to imagine an optimistic scenario, walk us through what the workday of a typical American might be.
Well, you're right to point out that there are different scenarios. And I think that is probably the most important point, is that there's no single inevitable future. It's going to depend entirely on how we choose to take action in these areas. And I do think there's a very optimistic scenario, and one that I hope is the more likely one. And that is one where there's no more physical wants and needs. Robots can take care of the work needed to provide food, clothing, shelter, and basic physical needs for everyone on the planet. We're not that far away from that point. The interpersonal skills won't be automated, but that's fine. There'll be room for people to do that, and we'll spend more time on interacting with each other and engaging in different kinds of leisure pursuits.
This sounds pretty good. So I'm going to be kicking back, painting landscapes and hanging out over coffee, talking with friends, and the robots are going to be doing all the work. Not bad.
I think it's a very realistic scenario, but it depends in large part on how we decide to allocate income and the wealth that's created. Because another scenario is one where the same amount of wealth is created, but it's highly concentrated in not even the 1%, but the 1% of the 1%. We have to decide what kinds of trade-offs we want between, say, creating more incentives for innovation and creating a more even distribution of income. That's a debate that we need to have, and I think that we will be having over the coming years.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to be a little more specific about the pessimistic scenario. Suppose we don't do this. Suppose we don't figure out ways to redistribute capital and wealth. What might the average day look like 50 years from now?
Yeah. Well, I see two broad kinds of pessimistic scenarios. The first one is the one that's an economic pessimism, where there's a tremendous amount of inequality. It's quite possible that the mass of people, more than 50%, more than 90% of people, will not be able to come up with anything that they can do that will create enough value to make for a living wage. But they could still be very, very angry and create a lot of destruction. I could easily see growing unrest and disorder. It's happened before, and there's no reason that it wouldn't happen again. So it's in the interest of all of us to think about ways of heading that off.
That is great. Thank you so much. This is fascinating.
My pleasure, and I hope we end up in that happy scenario that we discussed.
Me too.
Erik Brynjolfsson is a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management. His most recent book is called Wired for Innovation: How Information Technology is Reshaping the Economy. How are you shaping our common future? Let us know through Facebook or Twitter. Our handle's at TTBook1. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. In this hour, we're considering what life might be like for an average American 50 years from now. So far, that future self wakes up in a city, goes to work, if you have a job, and now it's time for lunch. But with the unpredictabilities of climate change and about 9 billion people living on the planet by 2050, what'll we eat? Jonathan Foley heads the Global Landscape Initiative at the University of Minnesota's Institute on the Environment. He told me, forget about the future.
Today, right now, we have three major challenges facing the world food system. One is the challenge of what we call food security, which is just a fancy way of saying, does everybody get enough to eat every day? And right now, we have 7 billion people in the world, but sadly, about a billion people don't have food security. They lack the income or the access or the infrastructure to get food every single day. That's not because we don't grow it. There's plenty of food being grown. It's just these folks don't have access to this, mainly because they're very poor or they live in places with bad institutions. And that's true many places in the world, including a little bit of the United States. The second big challenge, though, is the world's getting bigger. Population growth, we have 2 to 3 billion more people coming to the population in the next 50 to 60 years, possibly. Also, though, the world is getting richer. China alone will be adding about 500 million middle-class consumers in the next 10 to 20 years. And with that, we're seeing big changes in diet. Folks who are getting richer are looking to Europe and the U.S. and other places and saying, hey, maybe I want to eat more meat, more fats, more sugar, more oils, things like that. So between the economic growth and the population growth, we may be on a track of needing to about double the food availability in the world.
It's hard to break these things apart, isn't it? You can't really talk about how much food we produce without also considering getting it from the place of production to the people who need it.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, it's really ironic that the world grows a considerable amount of food, but then you have to ask, where does it go? We see a lot of the crops we grow are actually fed mainly to animals. If you drive across the Midwestern Corn Belt, you look at all that corn and all those soybeans. That isn't people food. It's mainly fed to animals and increasingly to make ethanol. So we have to think not only about how much we grow, but what we're using it for. And that's a pretty big opportunity, is around diets and biofuels and especially food waste. The world wastes about 40%, it's estimated, of all the calories grown in the world. We could do better than that.
I guess that we've established pretty well that there are problems. Will we be able to feed the increase in the population?
Well, it's yes and no. It depends on how you try to do it. Right now, we have a very, very pervasive kind of narrative out there that says, look, the world's population is getting bigger, people are getting richer, we've got to double the world's food supply. And I would say, yes, that's probably true. But then, therefore, we need to grow more stuff. And I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. We waste 40% of all the food we grow in the world right now. A lot more people are eating more things like meat and dairy products, which are not always very efficient. We're using more and more of our crops for biofuels, taking it away from the food system. So maybe we could conserve some of the food we have now and use it better rather than just simply growing more.
So how do we do that? Because the waste that you're talking about, the immediate reaction is, you mean the cereal that I threw away when I didn't eat my whole bowl this morning?
Well, there are two ways to look at this. One is exactly throwing things away. It's just basically losses along the supply chain. So it's either between the farmer and the marketplace, which happens a lot in poor countries. The farmer grew the crop, but it never got to market because it spoiled or, you know, couldn't be refrigerated or didn't get there on time. And that's a double tragedy. You lose food and the farmer loses the income. But in rich countries, we tend to throw away things post-consumer. It's in our refrigerators, our trash cans, our cafeterias, our dorms, our restaurants. And a lot of things can be done there, especially where there are large institutions.
So who is going to shape the future of food? Is it the government with increased regulation? Is it simply a matter of educating consumers?
Well, there's a lot of interesting forces playing out in the food system right now. Right now, we certainly have governments and their ability to regulate either how food is grown in agriculture, but mainly we do that through our farm bill, what we pay for and what we subsidize versus what we ignore. And that's a wildly distorted system, I think. But also industry has a big role here, too, whether it's the folks who provide the inputs to farmers or how farmers get their crops to the food processors. And that's pretty influenced by consumer opinion. You know, the big foodie movement in the United States and around the world now is changing people's attitudes around food quite a lot.
Is it changing it in a good way? I guess I'm curious. There's this argument between industry and organic or locally grown food. Is that a positive thing? Is that making a difference to people's diet?
I think it is improving people's nutrition somewhat. I'm not sure it's having that big an effect on, let's say, the global food system yet. For example, organic food is about, that's only about 1% or less of the global food system. And GMOs, which people get all upset about and everything, well, they're about maybe 10% of the world's food production. So 90% or 89% roughly is neither one. We tend to get very, very obsessed about kind of small things, like, you know, whether something is grown within 50 miles of your house. It turns out it doesn't matter that much to the global climate or the environment or any of that. What's really important is to do things like, can we stop deforestation in the Amazon and Indonesia, for example? Or, you know, is something certified organic or not? What's more important is that a good farm? Is it a farm that didn't pollute into its local water? Did it produce good, healthy food that people can eat? So how do we move beyond these labeling good and bad kind of thing to a more comprehensive, big picture view of agriculture?
Hmm. Let's pretend for a moment that these are situations that can be solved and that we are going to solve them. What do you think? What am I going to have for breakfast if I'm still alive 50 years from now?
Well, I think what we'll have to eat 50 years from now, I mean, who knows, but we'll probably be not that different than what we have today in many ways. I think, obviously we'll see more homogenization around the world. We'll see more people borrowing diets and cultures and food from each other. And that's a good thing, probably. But I'm actually pretty optimistic. I think we will make it. I think we'll be able to feed the growing world population. But I think we're going to get better about food waste. We might see a lot more deployment of technology, like having, you know, robots traveling around farm fields, kind of measuring soil nutrition and water content and growth. Maybe we'll have more sensors and kind of a ubiquitous kind of web presence, making sure as food travels around the world, it isn't getting spoiled or we know exactly where it is. But I would argue that maybe we could be optimistic about this with improvements in farming technology, not just genetics, but things like how we fertilize our soils, how we irrigate, And it might be very low-tech things, like using more manures and more drip irrigation and maybe borrowing from organic approaches and what we call agroecology. I think those things have a lot of promise.
These are things that society needs to do. There are economic possibilities. There are political possibilities. What about individual possibilities? What can an ordinary consumer do to make sure that there will be good food and clean water for our kids and our grandkids?
Well, I think the biggest role we have as individuals isn't just in our pocketbooks. I mean, a lot of people want to buy the local and the organic and the farmers markets and all that. That's great. But I think a more powerful thing you do when you do that is you set examples for other people, especially your kids or your coworkers or your friends. Everybody could have a backyard little garden to grow a salad in. That won't really make a dent in global food supplies, but it'll help teach people around you and yourself even how the food system works, how we have to take care of our soils and our plants. And I like to think of that as a gateway drug to getting people interested in food and being more healthy, more nutritious, but also respecting a lot more what farmers do. We need to reconnect people to the food system, and anything we can do to do that is probably a good thing to do at the individual level.
Jonathan Foley heads the Global Landscape Initiative at the University of Minnesota. All right, we're through the workday in 2050. Time to socialize. Maybe head home to spend time with a family. But as home and work change, so do families. The person we turn to for insight into family life is Stephanie Kuntz. She teaches history and family studies at Evergreen College. Now, Stephanie says she's a historian, not a futurist. So Anne asked her about how American families are changing right now, starting with a recent news headline.
Stephanie, the Supreme Court just gave same-sex couples access to the same marriage benefits as heterosexual couples, something that just 10 years ago would have seemed unthinkable. How else have our ideas of marriage and family changed in recent years?
Well, I would say that the change on the acceptance of same-sex marriage is one of the most rapid, stunningly rapid, when you think that it was the least likely to be accepted in terms of the changes that have occurred in the last 50 years. You know, people say, well, I'm for women's rights, or I'm for integration, but not for same-sex marriage. And yet, the opposition, which started higher, receded more quickly than opposition to any other social issue. So it's really a stunning change. I think that our ideas and values about marriage and family have changed in less than half a century, more than they've changed in the 2.5 centuries preceding. And actually, one could make an argument that they've changed in the last 5,000 years.
I know, it's hard to believe when you think back. This year marked the 50th anniversary of Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. And we take it for granted today that gender equality in a marriage is a desirable thing, but when she wrote that book, that wasn't the case.
No, more than two-thirds of Americans in 1963 agreed that the man should make the final decisions in the home. The man should be the breadwinner. So all of that has turned around really just in the last 30, 40 years.
Yeah, to the point that I think the majority of women today work, am I right?
The majority of women work, yes. There are more single-parent families than there are male breadwinner, female homemaker families in America.
And then I think thinking about men, men's roles have changed a great deal, too. I think men spend a significant portion more time parenting today than they did even 20 years ago.
Men have tripled the amount of child care they do and more than doubled the amount of house care they do over the last few decades. And now we're seeing that men are demanding an active role in family life. In intact marriages, they're spending more time with their kids than ever before. And if a divorce occurs, more men are fighting for joint custody or spending more time with their kids.
Yeah. It's the historical perspective is really fascinating because you realize how quickly all of this has changed. And yet, I mean, do you think we've achieved gender equality?
No, not at all. For example, when you look at men and women with equal educational credentials, women still earn less than men.
So what changes would we still need to accomplish to achieve gender equality? And I don't know, do you think it's going to take another 50 years?
It's hard to tell because there's so many differing kinds of interactions going on. I think the main changes we need to make are institutional. You know, America has the highest work hours for professionals in the world. On the other hand, we have such a gap between what's a livable wage and what most poorly educated workers can earn that often they have to work two jobs. So the work-family tensions in this country are very extreme. Our child care investment is minuscule. I'd say that it was like Neanderthal, except it turns out the Neanderthals took better care of their dependents than Americans do.
So what kinds of pressures have the forces you've been describing placed on the old-fashioned nuclear family? Is that still the defining social unit?
Well, yes. We no longer have extended families. There's some good things and some bad things going on. On the one hand, domestic violence rates have been halved. Self-reported sexual victimization has fallen by 70% for young women. We see that child abuse has decreased. So right now there are two countervailing forces that are going on in American family life. One is this incredibly wonderful increase in our demands for equality and fairness and respecting the individuality of all family members. But at the same time, in our social and economic life, we are going an equally strong direction toward increasing inequality, privatization, with all the results of insecurity, failure, and lack of trust that that sort of thing breeds. These are all bad for building the kind of community support systems and trust levels in which families can most thrive.
What about marriage? I mean, right now people are marrying less and later. Do you think marriage as an institution is going to die out eventually? I mean, do you foresee a time when we'll look back and think of it as an artifact of an earlier time?
No, I don't think that marriage is going to die out. But I do think that there's a very important change going on, that marriage as an institution that everybody has to join, that organizes your life, that has, you know, clear-cut rules, that notion of marriage is on the decline. At the same time, our expectations of marriage as a relationship are on the rise. The marriage rates for more educated people are not going down dramatically. And we find that the divorce rate for educated, economically secure people is going down too. But the same things that have made marriage more of a partnership have made it also in some ways more risky for low-income individuals who are under pressure. And we're finding that the same sort of mixture of social and economic and cultural change that has strengthened marriages for some sections of the population has made it increasingly difficult for low-income people to enter or sustain stable relationships, whether marriage or cohabitation.
So what I hear you saying is that we're looking at an increasingly bifurcated American social life in which marriage and stable relationships are for the upper middle class, and I don't know what the people at the bottom end get.
Well, yes. And what I think, though, that we are seeing and what I think is troubling for lower income Americans is that they really are rightly cautious of rushing into marriage. We know that a woman who gets married, has a baby, and stays married is clearly better off, but she often sacrifices her own earnings potential to the effect that if she divorces, she may be worse off. So we're having this pressure, though, because at the same time, low-income people move into relationships, cohabiting relationships, much more rapidly than high-income. That is partly a result of economic need. And unfortunately, those relationships are less likely to be stable because they haven't had the time to put into it that a modern cohabiting relationship really requires.
So, Stephanie, you're a historian. I'm curious, looking back to look forward, what kind of impact might the biggest change agents, you know, like global warming or the internet, have on our social and family lives? And how much do we know about how people react to big upheavals like that?
Well, I have to say that I think global warming is a real game changer. I really don't think there is a good historical precedent for such a massive and global challenge to the way we live. The internet, again, doesn't it depend on how we use it?
What kind of effect on families do challenges like this have? I mean, populations, the human population has gone through countless huge upheavals. What kind of larger social impact do upheavals like these have?
Well, again, it depends how we react to them. I mean, everybody knows the many examples of how people respond to emergencies, floods, the tsunami. There's an outpouring of wanting to help other people. But if that takes place over time with a long developing crisis where that human desire to help is not channeled, then it seems that it does lead to the kind of me first, scared of what's going to happen, take care of my own family activity that is bad for society and in the long run really does not create good family relationships and values.
Well, Stephanie, it sounds like, I know historians don't like to predict, but it sounds like one thing we can predict for sure is that we've got a bunch of choices to make.
Yes, hard choices that we'd better make soon.
Stephanie Kuntz teaches history and family studies at Evergreen College. You can find links to some of her recent New York Times articles through our website, ttbook.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. In all this talk about the future, we should probably remember that the past tends to repeat itself. It's one of the themes that runs through Children of the Days, the latest book from the lauded Latin American author Eduardo Galeano. The book has an entry for every day of the year. They range from tales of ancient Egypt to the story of a human cannonball launching over the U.S.-Mexico border. Steve asked Galeano what inspired the book.
It's a strange book. It's born from a sentence I heard years and years ago in a Mayan community in Guatemala. One night, some of the comrades was speaking about the Mayan culture as the only one in the Americas in which time is the mother and the father of space. Mm. And he ended saying, "We are all daughters and sons of days." And so I began to think in a possible book, if we are sons and daughters of time, then we are made of atoms, but also made of stories, each one of us, mm-hmm. you and I, we contain a lot of stories. So today may be able to tell the stories we contain.
Well, we should give some examples. So what you do is you pick every day. There's a historical anecdote. Your January 3rd episode marks the day when the greatest library of the ancient world, the Library of Alexandria of Egypt, was burned to the ground.
On the third day of the year 47 before Christ, the most renowned library of antiquities burned to the ground.
After Roman legions invaded Egypt, during one of the battles waged by Julius Caesar against the brother of Cleopatra, fire devoured most of the thousands upon thousands of papyrus scrolls in the Library of Alexandria. A pair of millennia later, after American legions invaded Iraq during George W. Bush's crusade against an imaginary enemy, most of the thousands upon thousands of books in the Library of Baghdad were reduced to ashes. Throughout the history of humanity, only one refuge kept books safe from war and conflagration, the walking library, an idea that occurred to the Grand Vizier of Persia, Abdul Qasim Ismail, at the end of the 10th century. This prudent and tireless traveler kept his library with him. 117,000 books aboard 400 camels formed a caravan a mile long. The camels were also the catalog. They were arranged according to the titles of the books they carried, a flock for each of the 32 letters of the Persian alphabet.
That's an astonishing story. 117,000 books on 400 camels in a caravan, a mile
it's
long.
The only safe library.
So where do you find a historical anecdote like that? How did you do the research to find these bits of forgotten history?
They come. The stories come and touch me, touch my shoulder or my back, and say, tell me, I deserve to be told. So I'm sure that you were able to write it. Tell me, tell me. I have a long line of candidates of days that want to be told.
August 9, International Day of Indigenous Peoples. Rigoberta Menchú was born in Guatemala 4 centuries and a half after the conquest by Pedro de Alvarado and 5 years after Dwight Eisenhower conquered it once more. In 1982, when the army swept through the Mayas highlands, nearly all of Rigoberta's family was wiped out. Erased from the map was the village where her umbilical cord had been buried so she would set down roots. 10 years later, she received the Nobel Peace Prize. She declared, I receive this prize as an homage to the Maya people, even though it arrives 500 years late. The Mayas are a patient people. They have survived 5 centuries of butchery. They know that time, like a spider, weaves slowly.
So this is really a book about remembering, right? And it's particularly remembering forgotten history.
Yes. I'm trying to help to recover, to rediscover the human rainbow, which is so bright and beautiful and colorful, but it has been mutilated by a long, long time of racism and machismo and militarism and so many other isms. No, we are blind. We are not able to see each other, and discovering in each other, in your neighbors, in everybody, including yourself, all these hidden bright colors, luminous colors, especially because this mutilated memory has deleted from the past.
Well, of course, there's that saying that history is written by the winners.
Yes, which is true. In the official memory, we have so many women that should be there and are not, and black people and Indians, and enormous list of statues that should be instead of statues that should not be but are.
May 30, from the stake to the altar. On this day in 1431, a 19-year-old girl was burned alive in the old marketplace at Rouen. She climbed the scaffold wearing an enormous cap which said, heretic, recidivist, apostate, idolatress. After she was burned to death, her body was thrown from a bridge into the Seine so the waters would carry her far away. She had been condemned by the Catholic Church and the Kingdom of France. Her name was Joan of Arc. Heard of her? January 24. Civilizing Father. On this day, in 1965, Winston Churchill passed away. In 1919, when presiding over the British Air Council, he had offered one of his frequent lessons in the art of war. I do not understand this squeamishness about the use of gas. I am strongly in favor of using poisoned gas against uncivilized tribes. The moral effect should be so good and would spread a lively terror. And in 1937, speaking before the Palestine Royal Commission, he offered one of his frequent lessons on the history of humanity. I do not admit that a great wrong has been done to the Red Indians of America or the black people of Australia by the fact that a stronger race, a higher grade race, has come in and taken their place.
is part of your project with this book that we've been talking about, Children of the Days, but more than that, with a lot of your other books, is it to bring back the history of Latin America in particular?
Basically, yes. But I'm not only trying to recover Latin America's memory, but I'm trying to receive and give stories happening in all places of this world. And this is giving me, and I hope perhaps it will give other people, certainty that I may be, and you may be, and all of us may be, compatriot of people born in very, very distant places, and contemporaries of people who lived centuries or millenniums ago. Sometimes it happens when I read an old, old, old poem by some Chinese poet written in much before Jesus Christ was born. I feel that this man was my brother and is still my brother each time I read this poem. I believe in the universality of the human condition, not in globalization, which is the universality of money. I mean the universality of the best of us, the will of justice and the will of beauty.
January 12, the rush to get there. On this morning, in the year 2007, a violinist gave a concert in a subway station in Washington, D.C. Leaning against a wall alongside the usual litter, the musician, who looked more like a local kid, played the works of Schubert and other classics for three quarters of an hour. 1,100 people hurried by without slowing their pace. Seven paused a bit longer than a moment. No one applauded. Some children wanted to stay, but they were dragged off by their mothers. No one realized he was Joshua Bell, one of the most esteemed virtuosos in the world. The Washington Post had organized the concert. It was their way of asking, do you have time for beauty? Eduardo Galeano's latest book is called Children of the Days, A Calendar of Human History. You can hear Steve's extended conversation with him and more readings from the book at our website, ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a copy of this program by calling a radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Possible Futures. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Sarah Nix, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Anne Strangechamps, with Audio Ingenuity by Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.